All right, and we should be live now. Welcome to Wealthion, everybody. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you guys back for our second Ask Anything live Q&A with the professional financial advisors who were recommended by Wealthion. You see them on this channel every week. From New Harbor, we have John Lodra and Mike Preston. Hi, John and Mike. How are you guys doing?
Hi, Adam.
Good morning.
Hello, Lance.
Great.
And hello, everybody.
Investment advisors, we have Lance Roberts. Hey, Lance. Good to see you, buddy.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah. It's only been, what, like...
Seems like it's just
3 hours since we were on. All right. So, folks, we're going to basically just take as many questions as we can in the next hour here. A bunch of people emailed questions in, and I'll start with a few of those. But as you guys ask comments here in the live chat, they're coming through, and I'll start pulling as many of those as I can as well. If any of you would like to be brought into the on-air experience here with your webcam and ask your question live directly to one of these experts, do me a favor, just raise your hand in the chat, give me your email address, and I will send you a link that will allow us to be able to do that. Hopefully that works. All right. This thing is going to be recorded afterwards, folks. So don't worry about furiously taking notes here during the live session, because you can always go back to the replay and rewatch later on. All right. So guys, let's get started here. We are talking on what day is today? It is the 23rd of May, 2022. We've had a pretty rough start to the year. One of the worst years in starts to the year in history for the markets. At one point on Friday, essentially, you know, the S&P generally was down about 20%. The NASDAQ was down about 30%. Cryptos were down about 40%. We're bouncing a little bit here for the moment, but it's definitely been a concerning year for investors. And a lot of people are wondering, have the beating stopped? Are things going to get better from here? Or if it's going to get worse, how much worse is it going to get? Why don't I start with the potential here for a bounce? Folks, I'm still learning this new software that we're using here, so bear with me. but I do have a chart to show here. This is from a tweet that Sven Henrik, a very well-known technical analyst, put up this morning. And he notes here, it's a chart of the S&P. He says, follow through on the upside following Friday's 3.82 fib tag. And if you look at this chart, it basically shows a couple of things. One, it shows that the S&P is trading at an extreme. And with both of these groups of financial advisors over the past bunch of weeks, we've talked about the markets being really sort of oversold. So this shows you that they're trading right at the bottom of their Bollinger Band, below a lot of their moving averages, in fact, below all of their moving averages. And on Friday, it's a little hard to see here, but it actually punched below the lower Bollinger Band, went down, touched that key Fibonacci level, and then came back up to close the day flat. And then we have an update so far today. And if you look at the RSI, which is the line there at the top, you're seeing that it's down. Sven circled it here. It's at a low extreme here. Those usually tend to be turning points. So why don't we start with this? And Lance, maybe I'll start with you, because we were talking about this a little bit on Saturday, and then we'll go to John and Mike. When you see data like that, does that give you more encouragement that, yeah, we may see some sort of relief rally here? Or as some people say, is it all just hooey?
Well, it's interesting. His chart was exactly the same chart I put in our newsletter this weekend, because you know, we were looking at the comparison between the market topping process that we're in now versus 2008. And it's a very similar pattern. We have a head and shoulders pattern that's been completed. We're now very oversold on a short-term basis, 38.2% retracement. You should get a bounce here. Now, that bounce should be used to sell into, because again, there's more work to do. There's a lot of what we call trapped longs at this point. A lot of individuals are long this market. They hate this market now. Remember, they all were in the SPACs and IPOs back in 2021 and 22. Now they just are trying to figure out some way to get out of the market. So every rally that we have is going to be a sellable rally here for a while, because of two reasons, really. One, there's still too many people that are trying to find where the bottom is. I'm getting a lot of calls from people going, I've got a bunch of cash, just tell me when to start buying. That is not what you see in a bear market. When you get to the bottom of a bear market, nobody wants to buy any stock. They just want to be out of the market entirely. So you know, there's a lot of similarities to 2008. Not saying we're going to have a financial crisis. You know, we're not going to have a Lehman moment, but credit spreads are starting to blow out here a little bit, starting to see some increases in some of the spreads. That's a worrisome sign. Starting to see some weakness in other areas of the markets as well. The economy is slowing down. We've got a very sharp build in inventories. Looks like we've got some signals now that are coming across that we're about to see a pretty sharp downturn in the employment market between layoffs and unemployment in general. You know, just announced, you know, just recently, Amazon talking about too much office space, too many employees. So, you know, that's coming. So, yeah, you know, we've had 8 straight down weeks in a row. Not surprising if we'd see 2, 3, 4 weeks of a pretty vicious counter trend bounce. Could be as much as, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10%. That'll be enough to get Jim Cramer on CNBC to start talking about the bull market. The bear market is over. The bull market's back. That's going to be your indication that it's time to start selling and raising some cash, because that'll be the point to where the next leg of this downturn will probably pick up.
All right. All right. Great. So let's go to New Harbor real quickly. John, why don't we start with you? Any additional color to add to what Lance just said there?
Yeah, no, this is exactly the kind of environment that you can and likely may see even sharp and significant short-term rallies. But I do think it's important to kind of understand that those are entirely possible in the context of a market that is perhaps shifting to more of a secular, longer-term bear market. And I actually have a couple slides that I want to share that, you know, kind of give some real historical a picture to that. So let me try and share my screen here. Bear with me here just a moment.
Yeah, folks, we're all learning this new software together.
Okay, can everybody see a chart here? All right, I think
yep,
so.
We'll see it.
So this is the 1973-74 market, bear market, and you know, it's notable that this is an environment that isn't too dissimilar from where we are right now in terms of an inflationary environment and a monetary central banking machine that is realizing they've got to do something here to kind of put the inflation genie back in the bottle. So I you can see there's a pretty massive decline there in 1973-74. And I extracted a quote here that I actually came across from a Wall Street Journal article yesterday that speaks of this very period. And I'll just read it. Most important, in 1974, the Fed kept raising rates even as a recession took hold because it was running to catch up with inflation. The result was a horrible bear market interspersed with soul-destroying temporary rallies. I really liked the use of words there. Two of 10%, 2 of 8%, and 2 of 7%. Each snuffed out. It took 20 months before the low was reached, not coincidentally, when the Fed finally began to get serious about cutting rates. And I did notice in the live comments section here, someone posed the question, you know, isn't it a fair assumption to think that this recent soft patch in the market might not be curtailed until the Fed pivots on their you know, rate rise jawboning. And I think that's a fair, you know, assumption to make. But the very next slide, if I can go here, let me see if I can get to the next one, speaks to that. Bear with me here. Let me see if I can get, yeah, here we go. This is the great you know, financial crisis period, the housing bubble 07 to 09. And here's the same kind of picture, totally different monetary regime. You know, the Fed wasn't raising rates, but in fact, it was putting monetary stimulus like at that point the world had never seen. So we have two regimes here, both a interest rate increasing regime and a monetary stimulus regime, neither of which, both scenarios we saw massive short-term rallies, even in the context of a very significant longer-term bear market.
That's actually a great chart there. You know, it shows that nothing moves in a straight line. And, you know, if you're waiting for that rally, as Lance was just saying earlier, those are great opportunities to unload at better prices. You know, if you think the longer term trend is going to be down like this, obviously those folks that sold at the plus 8% rally back in whatever that is, November of 07, that was the smart move rather than just holding it all the way down to 666 there at the end in February of 09. All right, those are great charts, John. Thanks for sharing them. All right. Well, Mike, we'll kick this next question off for you. But so John sort of already gave a nod to it. And if several people have asked this question, which is sort of, you know, how far down is down here, and what's going to trigger it? So this one fellow asked, could 3000 be the bottom on SPX? There's channel support there. So he was sort of looking at a similar chart as Lance's, where the key Fibonacci and trading levels were, and was saying, maybe it looks like 3000 may be the bottom. Other people are simply asking, is the bottom just going to be in whenever the Fed starts to pivot here? So it sounds like, talking to you guys, I want to say you're united, but correct me if I'm wrong, that you think if we do have a rally from here, it's a rally worth selling into. And then if you had to bet on probabilities, you think probably lower prices are still ahead at some point this year. And so if all that's true, I guess my question is, to these spirit of these two questions, is how low do you think low could go? Or maybe even more simply, where do you think the new Fed put is? What's the price at which the Fed steps in and really tries to stop the market bleeding? Mike, let's start with you.
Yeah, let me just say that nobody knows where the ultimate low will be in a bear market, and that we do think that we've entered a bear market. It's been kind of stealthy so far. If you look at the Wilshire 5000, it topped in November. The S&P topped in January. And this is at the end of a multi-year, absolute, monstrous, historic bull market. And so valuations have reached extremes or far beyond any extremes we've ever seen before, including 1929. And I can tell you by watching this market the last few months that investors are just really, really interested in buying the dip. You can watch it on an intraday basis. Literally everybody is trying to find the bottom all the way down. As of the low on Friday, we had wiped out all of the gains in the S&P for the entire year 2021. And 2021 was, I think, an example of, in so many ways, the most extreme market we've ever seen. You know, from SPACs to NFTs to Bitcoin to meme stocks, and even the S&P and NASDAQ just took off all year. And this was, of course, what I think, or what we think, is a blow off top in after the COVID stimulus. So here at the recent low, we didn't even close down 20%. And if you read some of the financial articles out there, they say something like this. Thankfully, we, you know, the S&P touched a bear market, but thankfully we avoided it because we had a big reversal on Friday. So the sentiment is like, phew, that could have been bad, but it wasn't. And still everybody is wondering where the bottom is. So it's very likely that we'd see a bounce, and we are seeing one today. That chart earlier that you put up that Sven Henrik did was really good, and it shows that we're sitting on that lower Bollinger Band. But let me tell you, the biggest and most rapid declines ever that I've seen in my career, and I've been doing this more than 20 years, come when you're at that Bollinger Band or even slightly below. Sometimes you'll just see a waterfall that happens right from then. And sentiment recently is pretty negative, I'll admit that. But overall, sentiment is a really, really poor timing tool. So we could absolutely bounce here. And textbook would be, just like Lance said, that we bounce 5 or 8 or 10% and give us another chance to sell into. Here's the problem. We're talking to a lot of people that are overinvested, that have been overinvested the whole time and really didn't realign anything in their portfolio. And here we are sitting at 3,900 or so, or close to 4,000. And they're all itchy with an itchy trigger finger, and they're saying, should I sell now? Should I sell now? And then there's a whole bunch of other people trying to time the turn. It's dangerous. It's really dangerous to try to game this thing. The fair value in the S&P, we could argue about valuations, but it wouldn't be that hard to believe that we could see a drop of 2/3 from this recent top. And that would be a bottom in the teens, 1600, 1800 on the S&P. It's absolutely possible from the valuations that we've seen, and it's not without precedent. So we would be using these rallies to realign your portfolio. And one last thing I'd say, and I tell this to people when I'm on the phone with them, we don't want to be doomers and say the sky is falling and it's never going to come back. The market's never going to come back. It will always come back over a long enough period of time. The problem is it may take a long time to do that. From 1929 to 1954, that was 25 years that it took to get back to even. From 1966 to 1982, 16 years it took to get back to even. So if you just take a look at your portfolio and get to an allocation you're comfortable with, no matter what, it's better than staying overinvested and getting frozen like a deer in the headlights. We would personally suggest an allocation lower in equities, 30% or so or less, even now. But you don't have to sell everything. You don't have to do anything rash. Just take a look at your allocations and adjust them, in our view, to the more conservative side, and you'll be able to weather what we think is likely coming better.
All right. Thanks, Mike. That reminds me of something I shared on Twitter over the weekend, which was basically sort of reminding folks about what prospect theory says, which is that we as humans psychologically feel the pain of a loss twice as much as we feel the benefit of a gain. Even though kind of on a day-to-day basis, we're tempted by gains all the time. Our animal brain really likes the idea of getting, you know, a big return. But when we experience a loss, we really do experience it much more than we do, you know, the gains that we have in our portfolios. And what I was sort of underscoring is, hey, in times of high market uncertainty, if you keep prospect theory in mind, it really is a good argument for, you know, playing it safer. Right. Because to your point, Mike, you know, if you get caught in a big downdraft, not only does it hurt a lot, but it also, you know, it sets you back years. And a lot of people watching this video right now are, you know, 50 or over, and they don't really have a lot of years left to make up for, you know, the potential type of decline that you were just saying. And I should note, too, that Jeremy Grantham just came out this week and reiterated his call that he thinks by the time this is over, it's going to be a lot lower than it is right now. Lance, let me come to you with a kind of a fun question here. It's a little gruesome, but kind of an interesting one, which is, as things continue to deteriorate here, sort of fundamentally with slowing economic growth and, you know, we should start seeing earnings come down because of inflation and slowing growth and stuff like that. You know, we will start seeing some companies weaken. Obviously, there's a lot of big funds and stuff out there that are probably already, we're probably going to start reading about them soon. Like we just heard that Melvin Capital is shutting down, right? That was the fund that took on GameStop. They made some other bets since then that also didn't work out well. And they're actually now just shutting down the hedge fund. But, you know, we talk about the indices being down 20, 30%. That's the indices. We've all spent a lot of time talking about how if you look at the individual stocks within those indices, if you take out the top 10 biggest ones, a lot of those mid and smaller companies, I mean, they're down 50, 60, 70%, right? So the question is really about who's going to blow up here. So a question comes from Vin. It says, who's going to be the Bear Stearns, the first to blow up of 2022? And then who is your candidate for being the Lehman Brothers of 2022? Like the systemic risk in the system.
Don't know. Unfortunately, that's the big thing. Now, one good thing here is that right now, what we don't have is we don't have a lot of the, you know, what appears to be a lot of the subprime issue that we had back in 2007. You know, a lot of banks have shored up in a lot of different ways. There's still a lot of funny math on their books. We never restored mark-to-market accounting. So honestly, the true answer is, we really don't know what's on their books because we never put mark-to-market accounting back on their books. So they're still marking stuff at what, you know, whatever they want to mark it at. But, you know, the question of who's the next Lehman Brothers, I don't know. But like I said, the one thing to watch here is to watch credit spreads between BBB rated bonds, BB rated bonds, and A rated bonds, those type of things. We're starting to see those spreads widen out. Now, that's what you would expect with the market coming down here. We are seeing some weaker economic growth. I just did some analysis over the weekend. Earnings estimates in just the last 2 weeks have fallen by almost 10% for the end of 2023. So we're starting to see those earnings revisions being ratcheted down really fast. That's going to start lifting up valuations again, even though markets have been coming down. Earnings have actually been going up the first quarter. So analysts were, even though the market was in a 20% decline here, analysts were still ratcheting up earnings. Well, now that's finally stopped and they're starting to bring those back down. So that's going to start to keep forward PE ratios a bit elevated here. But watch credit spreads. Now, they're not spiking yet. So what credit spreads are telling us at the moment is there's stress in the markets because of what's going on, but there doesn't seem to be any panic. And really, that's the way with the stock market as well. You know, yeah, we're down 20% this year. It feels terrible, right? I mean, if you just look at your portfolio, it's like, oh my gosh, I got a portfolio yesterday from a very nice lady, and she's like, I don't know what to do with my portfolio. It's with one of the largest advisors in the country, and you know, they're on every website, and they have commercials that run. They're, you know, they're a fiduciary, and we're on the same side of the table as you. It's great, right? They're down 30% for the year. 100% stocks. This lady's about 71, 72 years old. She's down 30% for the year.
That's now, tough.
That hurts. That hurts a lot. But, you know, that part feels terrible. But if you take a look at the volatility index, it's not spiking. In fact, over the last few days, even though the market was really coming down hard on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday last week, volatility was actually kind of making lower highs. And so there doesn't seem to be right now a lot of panic or financial stress in the market. Now, this is to the Fed's benefit at this moment. Now, remember, I've seen a chart here. It's like, you know, when's the Fed going to act? You know, when the Fed's going to do this? There's not enough financial stress going on right now to make the Fed come off of what they're doing. They're still focused on inflation. They're going to focus on inflation until they see financial stress. And when they see financial stress, then they're going to pivot back to cutting rates, doing QE, shoring up the financial markets. Because remember, the members of the Federal Reserve are the major banks. So when they get into trouble at some point, the Fed's going to reverse this policy. But again, to your point, Adam, is that it's hard to tell who's going to be the crisis boy. We won't know yet. When the Fed hikes rates far enough to break something, that's when we're going to find out who, as Warren Buffett says, we'll find out who's swimming naked. It may very well be a big hedge fund. You know, Melvin Capital has no clothes right now. So we're finding out what, you know, all those bad bets he made, you know, he's gotten caught. I am sure there's some big hedge funds out there that are on the wrong side of this trade. We're seeing a lot of hedge funds, you know, de-lever very quickly right now. And that's because they're in trouble.
All right. And John, I'll come to you to just see if you have anything to build on top of this, but let me ask the clarifying question of, you know, Lance said that the financial system may not be as unstable as it was back in 2008 because of all the horrible loans that the banks were making there, right? Like the 2008 crisis was largely triggered by a fear that the banking system was going to collapse, right? But I'm thinking on sort of the corporate side of the ledger, the corporations themselves, I can't remember the exact number, but it's like 20% or something like that are officially zombie corporations, right? Mm-hmm. Where they have to continue to borrow just to make their interest payments. And they've been able to do that while interest rates have been so low, but now yields are coming up, right? And the Fed is out there actively continuing to hike, and which is presumably only going to make it worse. You know, could the match here this time be on the corporate side, where you just start having a cascade of failure of these zombie corporations?
Yeah, that's a great question. And like Lance, it's really impossible to know where the rot is. Only to step back and know that anytime we look back in history where there's been such excess in monetary policy and other things, there is rot. We have to assume there's rot, and where it exactly exists will expose itself. And to Lance's point, yeah, one of the very first actions that was done in response in 2009, near the market low in 2009 after the housing bubble, is the suspension of mark-to-market accounting and some of the banks. And some credit that to being the main reason why the market's bottom, because suddenly this toxic pool of stuff was just swept under the rug for no one to see. And we still don't know. Now, the presumption is that through over a decade now of bank-friendly policies, things like interest on excess reserves, which basically involves the Fed paying banks interest that otherwise should have gone to savers as they've driven interest rates to zero. It's kind of disgusting, but you have to make the assumption that perhaps the banks are in slightly better shape than they were in the housing bust, but we now have to talk about the shadow banking system and all the excesses that have gone in there. Unregulated banks and financial firms that are, you know, the so-called shadow system. Not to mention in the corporate world, as you pointed out, Adam, the debt is massive, and the quality of that debt, unlike other debt expansion periods, is lesser quality. You know, there's been more junk debt issued at lower yields than perhaps ever before. The spreads of junk corporate bonds relative to high quality treasuries is and I think still remains near record narrow spreads, which is speaking to, you know, investors not getting paid properly for the risk that they're taking. But even the terms of corporate bonds have become much less protective, you know, so-called covenant light debt, where traditionally bond holders or investors in corporate bonds were given all kinds of protections to, you know, call back their principal in the event of financial covenants being violated by some of the companies, you know, certain debt to service cash flow ratios and things like that. Many of those protections are not anywhere to be seen in the massive amount of corporate debt that has been issued over the last decade. So what you have here is a ticking time bomb as investors start to realize as they chase for yield due to the low interest rates that the Fed engineered, they let down their defenses and invested in all kinds of stuff that doesn't give them protection like that they used to. So I think investors are going to find out the hard way that if we do reach a real recessionary crunch here, some of this corporate paper is just going to be toxic and it's going to evaporate and default unless the Fed somehow is able to come in and once again bail out that steaming pile of mess. But I think the political runway for doing that is much narrower, if not run out, especially given the inflationary environment.
All right,
John, can I disagree with you on that last statement?
Sure.
the only reason I say that is look, you know, whether you're conservative or liberal or whatever, I don't think that matters anymore. I think, you know, we've now gotten to the point where people just want to get elected and reelected. And, you know, honestly, I think if we get into another problem like we had March of 2020, where, you know, corporate structures are in trouble of failing. And, you know, look, as a good example, Boeing spent 10 years using all their cash flow to buy back stock and enrich executives. And the first thing that happens when they get in trouble, they run to the government for a bailout and they were happy to give it to them. And I think they're going to do that regardless of, you know, what political party affiliation you're with, because they just want to get reelected. So, you know, checks to households and all that. I understand what you're saying about the political environment may be a whole lot, you know, less of a runway, but I did political talk for 10 years. I've interviewed every one of these guys up in Washington at one time or another. And they all were telling me during the Obama administration that, oh yeah, you know, when we get into control, we're going to cut the budget and we're going to cut spending and we're going to salvage Social Security. Well, they had that under Trump and they did nothing. They spent 4 years doing absolutely nothing to fix our financial system. And in fact, in a lot of cases, they actually even made it worse. We ran up more debt. We had more insolvency and structures. Had a lot of these zombie companies really started to develop under the Trump administration to a great degree because of low interest rates. Not saying it was, you know, Trump's fault by any stretch of the imagination. It's just the political environment. And I don't think that's going to change if we get into the next round of trouble, which we will when the Fed breaks something. I think they're going to come running to the rescue and the Fed's going to start buying junk bonds again through BlackRock like they did before. And I think we'll be back to the same game model. Just my opinion, though.
All right, great. And I love the back and forth. So if on any of these questions, you know, you guys have a reaction to what the other person says, please do chime in. That's what makes a market. All right. So I want to switch now to, I do want to get soon, because we're at the half hour mark here. I do want to get soon to more sort of tactical questions about sort of decisions you guys are making right now in terms of investing in this current environment. But a few more macro questions first. See a number of different questions here that have to do with the dollar and the current strength of the U.S. dollar. At its most general, one's just saying, hey, what's going on with the dollar? But obviously, it's strengthening pretty substantially. And let me combine this with this related question, which is, you know, despite all of the uncertainty that we're seeing in the markets right now, should we expect that sovereign and foreign wealth is going to start piling into U.S. equities, or just U.S. you know, markets, but probably equities too, as a safe haven asset, meaning, you know, it's the cleanest shirt in the hamper. At least it's giving some return where other markets aren't, or maybe it's giving, even if it's losing, it's providing a negative return. It's a less negative return than certain other markets, at least right now. So do you guys sort of expect the U.S. to benefit from these capital inflows if the global macro situation continues to worsen? Mike, why don't we start with you?
Adam, absolutely. The dollar should remain strong. I'm not saying that it necessarily deserves it, but it probably will remain strong for a while. My best guess is a couple of years, but who knows? Long term, there's likely going to be some problems with the dollar. In long term, there's probably going to be some more problems with inflation. We actually think that short term, potentially deflation could be more of a problem. And we could have an asset price correction, which, you know, could yield deflationary pressures. But the United States runs a trade deficit. We've been doing it for a long, long time. And so we've been flooding the world with dollars, and we still have the most powerful military in the world. And so where do people send their money when there's problems or concern in the world? Well, to the United States, obviously. And it's because they have a lot of dollars, too. And so the dollar probably will remain strong here for a while. And at least probably, and if you ask me when the dollar would become a problem, it's probably when confidence is lost, both in the dollar and the Federal Reserve's ability to bail out the financial system. And as goes the United States, the rest of the world follows. So we have no doubt that we'll see a major price correction in assets. And I don't think that what we've seen is it. I think there's more to come. And similarly, have no doubt that the Fed will try to print money over and over again. We believe that at some point, the market is likely to lose confidence in that ability. No guarantee that forecast is right. But given history, you know, given what's happened in history throughout various different eras, eventually something that is too contrived and too interventionist ultimately breaks or fails. And at that moment, then the dollar should be under major pressure. But that's probably not until we see another bigger economic crisis or contraction, followed by central banks, i.e. the Fed, printing more and more and more. And ultimately, if that fails, well, watch out. That's a big problem. But for the short term, the dollar should remain strong.
Hey, Adam, if I could share a quick slide here that kind of speaks to the cleanest dirty shirt. I got a good chuckle out of it, and I hope some others will. So let me just share a quick screen here. Bear with me here. All right, so I came across this thing the other day by none other than Goldman Sachs. And, you know, for the longest part of the decade, last decade, there's been this TINA. There is no alternative, right? You got to invest in stocks because cash is paying zero. Well, now Goldman comes out with this flash news. Goodbye, TINA. Hello, Terra. So goodbye, there is no alternative. Please meet, there are reasonable alternatives. And I think this is a really important, if not comical, headline, because that's really what has gripped the last decade, this concept that you have to chase for yield because cash is earning zero. Well, I think we're starting to see that cash isn't such a bad place to be when both stocks and bonds are getting pummeled and, you know, quite possibly could have much further to go. And the idea of that, if money does move into the U.S. markets because of the things you just talked, it doesn't have to go into U.S. stocks. It could be going into treasury bills or other safe haven assets. I think there's been a paradigm shift here that I think this headline from Goldman speaks to quite nicely.
Adam, you're muted.
Thank you. That's a great point, John. And I'm going to go back to something that I said a couple of times leading up to the start of this new year, which was, you know, I'd go on these rants against the Fed because they had artificially suppressed returns. And so they were forcing people, particularly, you know, older people who needed return to live on, further and further out in the risk curve. And I made the analogy of it was pushing them further and further out on a thinner and thinner ice. But because they had done it for so long, people got used to it and they were beginning to treat the ice with the confidence of concrete. And of course, the danger there is, you know, when you get to too thin ice, you break through and you go, you know, straight down. And that's sort of what has happened this year, right? You know, everything looked great going into December. And then, you know, come from January to here, it's been a really rude awakening for a lot of people. And a lot of people have lost a lot of money. Like, you know, Lance was talking about that you know, woman in her 70s who lost 30%. You know, that's going to be very hard to recover from. Lance, I thought it was funny here. Somebody asked if that person was Kathy Wood.
No, she's more. She's like
80. She is down a lot more. All right. So I want to stay on the dollar just for a second. And Lance, I'll come to you now. But because I want to get to the, like, why matter. Okay, so what matters about this? Okay, so when we talk about a strong dollar, we're generally talking about it versus other fiat currencies. And that does, you know, have important implications with capital flows and profitability. If you're a multinational and a lot of your profits are out of the U.S., well, then the strong dollar actually, you know, hurts the value of those profits, stuff like that. The dollar is also rising against, besides other fiat currencies, it's rising against almost every other asset right now, right? You know, compared to the S&P, the dollar is up 20% this year, or at least the S&P is down 20% versus the dollar. The reverse math is a little wonky. I've heard from all of you guys that for months now that you have been building cash, right? And I think that was a wise call given the market, the way that the market's played out since. What other implications do we need to be aware of this rising dollar? You know, will it eventually crimp some of the commodity performance that's gone on? Are there other things we should be looking at? So let's go to you, Lance.
Yeah, well, so a couple of things. Remember that when we talk, let me back up a little bit. So 2 years ago, I got into a major feud with a guy from MarketWatch over the direction of the dollar. And he was like, the dollar is going to crash and it's going to be terrible. I'm like, no, it's not. The dollar is about to take off for a rally. And over the next 2 years, it's going to be substantially higher. And the reason for that was simply that you have to remember that, first of all, every currency in the world is now fiat. So, you know, we're all off on this bent saying, oh, the dollar's got to crash. It's a fiat currency. So is every other currency. Bitcoin, guess what? It's a fiat currency, because there's no asset behind it. And all fiat means is there's nothing behind it. And so what guarantees the payment of the dollar is the full faith and credit of whatever government issues that currency. So all we're talking about is, you know, we're talking about a currency being strong or weak. It's strong or weak relative to a basket of other currencies. So right now, as a good example, yes, we have inflation and we have, you know, higher interest rates, which for other countries which have weaker economic growth than the U.S., this is now a very attractive thing, because if I now have reserves, say I live in France and I've got a bunch of reserves, well, I'm looking for a couple of things. I'm looking for a place to where I know if I put my money, and we've talked about this before, but if I put my money in this country, I want to know that I'm going to get it back, right? There's recourse. There's a rule of law. So that's very important. That's a critical aspect. Rule of law is a critical aspect to currencies and transactions and business. Second thing is that when I take my currency and I put it into another country, the French franc never leaves France. The dollar never leaves the shore of the U.S. So if I'm going to move a currency, I have to convert that currency into U.S. dollars. Well, how do I do that? Well, I buy U.S. treasuries. So when money flows come to the U.S., and yeah, even though interest rates on the 10-year treasury have been going up, there's actually been a lot of inflows coming into U.S. treasuries because money's shifting over now because of investors looking for a higher yield. And it's interesting, you know, when John was just talking about Tina versus Tara, you know, it's right, because when rates were near zero, we were at 0.5% on the 10-year treasury back in 2020. Yeah, there really was no alternative. Now at near 3%, that's a decent alternative compared to foreign currencies. The other side of this is saying, okay, look, I hate the United States. I think the country sucks. I don't want to have any money there. Okay, great. That's fine. That's your prerogative. If you live in another country and you don't like the U.S., okay, fine. Where are you going to put your currency? You know, there's a problem of both depth of liquidity, the ability to conduct transactions, and the stability of those regimes and those currencies. And this is why everywhere in the world, if you're going to talk about commodity prices as an example, it's all contracted in U.S. dollars because of stability, liquidity, and rule of law. That's really why everybody wants to conduct business in the U.S. dollar. Now, how do you lose that? Well, how do you lose that and become Weimar Germany? Well, you've got to lose a war. You've got to have some economic debacle of such great magnitude. Think about the Depression, that people are worried that you're not going to be able to make good on your debt. You're not going to be able to pay your debts. Remember, because they don't own currency, they own U.S. treasuries. So when there is a belief that the United States can no longer service its debt, that's when you're going to get your dollar collapse, because now dollars are going to leave the U.S. to go to somewhere else. I don't know where that would be, but maybe they'll put it in the Japanese JGB. I don't know. But money will go elsewhere if there's a threat of the loss of a war, threat of economic collapse of great magnitude, unrecoverable magnitude. And that's why Weimar Germany blew up, right? They were losing World War I. So you've got to keep, you know, look, there's a lot of great doom and gloom headlines out there that'll keep you glued to the media and really lead you to making a lot of bad decisions long term. Because pay attention to how it works economically, but also pay attention to what's happening in the market specifically. And the dollar's telling you, look, there's been people talking about the dollar collapse since last year. It ain't happening, folks, because there's a lot of reasons why the dollar's getting stronger and will probably remain stronger for some time. Now, to your commodity question, it's an interesting dichotomy right now, because normally a stronger dollar makes things more expensive for foreign purchasers. So normally you have an inverse correlation between commodities and higher dollars. But right now we have these supply chain issues that are allowing commodities and the dollar to run at the same time. That'll eventually work itself out as supply chains come back online, as we get production back online. Inventory builds are massive at retailers right now. Walmart, Target, Ross Stores, all talking about too much inventory. That's going to work itself out over the course of the next 12, 18 months. And I suspect that we'll start to see commodities pick up their inverse relationship to the dollar again at that point. But we'll see. But you know, right now, just pay attention to what the dollars look. This is all assets. Pay attention to what these assets are doing, because that's the real message. Forget the doom and gloom headlines. Pay attention to what assets are telling you, because that's where the story is. And that's what you need to be paying attention to more than anything else. You're muted again.
Thanks. It's so frustrating. All right. So I'm trying to, there's so many questions coming in here, fast and furious, on so many different topics. So I'm trying to sort of pull themes out of here. And I want to stick with this just for a minute of cash still. So I'm seeing a lot of cash is king. You want to hold on to your cash now to have dry powder to deploy at the lower prices that are coming. So John and Mike, let me come to you guys to kind of build on that. But let me throw in commodities as well, which is sort of like, at this moment in time, are you guys still in agreement with sort of that statement that, like, look, you know, of all the things you can do, having cash to deploy later on is one of the best steps you can have right now. And then secondly, you know, what other asset classes right now are looking good enough for you guys to either be holding or buying, or at least considering buying at this point? John, let's start with you.
Okay, sure. You know, I on the cash, I wanted to share a chart here. I'm chart happy today, I guess. But this is a chart I came across on Twitter. So I don't have the data, but it's I think illustrative. This is okay, there we go. So this is a chart that shows back to 1992, I guess, 93. Yeah, the Schwab kind of survey of client cash. This is retail, you know, typically self-directed investors. The pink or fuchsia line is as measured on the right side axis is basically the percent cash held by retail clients. And overlaid is a chart of the S&P 500. You know, we're still, and this is to, I think, Lance's point earlier about the lack of, you know, kind of panic or capitulation. You know, by and large, retail investors are still very much invested. They have very little cash, you know, allocations in their portfolios. And this is what Mike talked about earlier, you know, to kind of people seem to be a little paralyzed, even though they're maybe a little concerned about where markets are. But you notice a major market bottoms, you look at, here in the tech market bottom and here the housing market bottom, the cash percentage typically is a contrary indicator, meaning people go to cash at the wrong time, not at the top, but at the bottom. So, you know, by all metrics, it appears that folks are still, at least in the retail world, and there's other surveys, you know, right now, if you look at professional, Bank of America fund manager survey, they're at the highest cash levels going back to 9/11. So you have professional fund managers that, you know, still modest amounts of cash, but the highest amount since 2001, not 9/11. And retail investors still very much invested. So this, you know, holding on to this market, even though it's showing cracks is pretty evident in this chart.
It's a great chart, and John, it reminds me of that saying about if you don't know who the patsy is at the poker table, it's you, right? And we sort of talk about the retail investor, unfortunately, sort of being Wall Street's patsy in the great poker game of Wall Street. And so what you just said really drives that home for me, which is that the retail investor is still pretty all in the markets in a way that they've rarely been over the past 30 years, where you just said the banks themselves have as much cash as they had built up, in safety around 9/11. That's accurate, right?
Yeah, actually, that's the Bank of America fund manager survey. So mutual fund managers are holding the highest cash percentages.
So fund managers, but basically average people are all in where the pros are sitting on record percent cash.
Yeah, I don't want to overplay this data, but it is, I think, emblematic of this. Being deer in the headlights.
Yeah, Adam, you see the same thing in the AAII, the American Association of Individual Investors, and their cash allocations. They're still at very low cash. They're still not convinced this is a bear market. Back to John's chart real quick. John, if you can share that chart again, I wanted to point out something that, I don't think people have really kind of gotten their head around here at the moment. So that bottom, you see the bottom in March of 2020 and this near vertical advance that the market took from March 2020 lows to the recent peak. And now that little curl off the top, that's that 20% decline that we're in. So that's a 38.2% retracement right now from that March 20 lows. Now, put this in the back of context of your mind. If we get back down to the February 2020 peak, right, before we collapse, that's a 61.8% retracement of that rally. So markets are going to have to be off that much from there. They're going to give up 61.8% of their previous rally to get back to where we were in February of 2020. When we were talking about then, the market was melting up. We had excess valuations. We had all this stuff going on. Now, this is where it gets really bad. To get to the March, go back to the March 2020 lows, that would not be unreasonable. And if you draw a trend line from the 2009 bottom through that March 2020 low, that's your bullish trend line, right? So everybody was talking, and here's the point I wanted to make. And this is the problem with how we look at markets. Everybody was freaking out on Friday because we're down 20% from the peak and it's a bear market. No, it's not a bear market. We have not changed the bullish trend of the market at all. You're going to have to come down and break the February 2020 peak to even start talking about breaking the bullish trend. Now you're in a bear market at that point. You've gone from correction to bear market territory. Your bear market takes you down to the 2015 lows, which you can see you're going to give up basically 6 years worth of advance very quickly when you get to a bear market. So that's the risk. And the reason I wanted to just point this out is people don't grasp the risk of what Mike was talking about in terms of a bear market. Because if we get into a real bear market, one that is, you can't measure these 20% declines because we've deviated markets from long-term means and bullish trends at this point to such a great degree. 20% is nothing. It's a blip. I mean, you can see that 20% decline barely shows up right now. You get into a real bear market, the financial devastation for individuals is going to be huge. And where the Fed steps back in, I think they're back in long before we get to that point. But I just want to, the point is that if you're talking about a 50% decline from the March 2009 lows, you're talking about getting back to 2015, 2016. And there's going to be a lot of financial devastation if that happens.
Yeah, I just chuckled because, Lance, I'm just thinking back to the days where you used to tease me about being too bearish.
Well, I'm not trying to be bearish. I'm just trying to put it into context.
I know.
About a bear market, 20% is not a bear market anymore. It's just a correction within an uptrend.
Right.
And that's where we are right now.
Hey, John, I hate to ask you to do this. Can you bring that chart up one last time?
It's a great chart, John. Just leave it up. We got the rest of the show, that chart.
Yeah. Next time we do this, we're just going to put that chart up for now.
Exactly.
Well, now I'm feeling guilty. I can't get proper attribution. So whoever out there in Twitter sphere posted this, thank you very much.
Yeah. All right. This is hard to see, but John, if you can just bring your cursor up and just sort of circle it over the peak of the market there, right at the end. It's a little hard to see, but we've seen expanded charts of this. that really do seem to show a head and a shoulders pattern. And, you know, if a head and shoulder pattern completes and you break the neckline, yeah, then things can really start going down. Looking at this, do you guys think this has broken the neckline?
Yeah, it has. I covered this in last weekend's newsletter. You broke it and you tested the neckline and you failed. So technically you've completed a head and shoulders pattern. So a rally back to that next line that fails should be your opportunity to sell into. And again, that's not very far from here. That's why we're 50 moving averages.
And if you want, Adam, I can share a slightly easier to read chart.
Please do. Please do. And folks, while he's doing that, meant to ask this earlier, but let us know how you're enjoying this new format, both the live Q&A with all our great financial advisors here, as well as the new system that we're using to bring it to you. Just make a comment in the comment section below. You know, looks good, looks bad. I want more of it, want less of it. All right, Mike, here's your photo. But Mike, you're on mute there.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry about that. This is a weekly chart of the S&P going back a couple of years. And here's the head and shoulders that we just talked about. Here's the left shoulder, the head, the right shoulder. The neckline here is indicated by this red line right around 4,100. We broke through that. And you know, you could move these lines around. Maybe some people will argue with me and say it should be more of a downsloping line. It doesn't really matter. Technical analysis is not exact, but if you just kind of step back and look at the broad picture, a you know very clear head and shoulders top is indicated here. And you can see that we're rallying this week so far after all of these down weeks. But frankly, the projection of this top, as I've written it here, or as I've illustrated here, would be basically the difference between the head and the right shoulder. That is about 700 points, and you would take 700 points, subtract that from 4,100, bringing you down to around 34, 35. And that would actually retrace all of this breakout back to this breakout point. So I wouldn't be surprised to see us get down to 34, 3,500 pretty quick. That would probably coincide with some type of capitulatory moment, which I would argue we've seen nothing like that yet. And that would also probably coincide with a VIX much higher. As Lance said, here's a weekly chart of the VIX. VIX has not been getting jumpy. It's sitting here around 28, and this is kind of this downsloping move here. I would expect VIX to get somewhere up around here, 45 to 50, if we had that next capitulatory drop, and that would coincide probably with around 34, 3500, just based on rough numbers with the charts.
Great. And well, that really does show you what sort of an orderly sell-off it's been, because if at the beginning of the year, if I had told you, hey, in the next 5 months, S&P is going to be down 20, NASDAQ is going to be down 30, you would have said, well, VIX would have shot the moon then, right? But it really hasn't yet.
Well, and interesting enough on this chart, and I absolutely agree with Mike's analysis. He's spot on. You know, I think you get that rally to 4,100 right now. That's about where the 50-day moving average is sloping down right now. So you're probably going to connect at 4,100. That provides a really good level to sell at. And then to Mike's point, I think you get that next leg of the sell-off that gets you down into that 3,400, 3,500, 3,600 range, depending on how aggressive it gets. And he's right. You know, we should start to see finally that kind of that capitulatory nature of the market. And again, I'm surprised after all the selling that we've had, we haven't seen more selling like that, but it's been very calm at this point, which scares me a little bit.
Scares you a little bit because you think at some point something could snap and it could get really uncalm quickly.
Yeah. That's the big risk. You know, the thing we don't know, look, if you take a look at inflation, interest rates at this point, what's happening economically, look at the manufacturing indexes that are going on right now. We've got big declines in all the manufacturing service indexes. There's a tremendous amount of financial tightening that's going on in the system. Liquidity is coming out of the system. All that liquidity we injected is now gone. So that financial tightening is already really occurring to a large degree. And now the Fed's going to jump on top and start putting a whole bunch more tightening on top of it. You know, I just don't see how you don't come out of this without breaking something. And like we talked about earlier, going back in history, every time the Fed has hiked rates, they broke something. it just showed up in different things. It was either portfolio insurance in 87. It was Orange County bankruptcy. It was the bond market crisis in 94. It was long-term capital management, just in a series after series, what shows up, and everybody will look back at it at some point and go, yep, that was evident. The Fed did it. We're just not there yet.
All right. Two questions for you. I'm kind of munging from some of the comments here. So I know the exact answer is going to be, we'll have to see what the landscape looks like at that exact moment, to make the final decision. But just talking to a high level here, to Lance's point about, the Fed continuing to hike until something breaks, and then the Fed is forced to step in and switch back from quantitative tightening back to quantitative easing. What investments would you make at that moment? So the news hits the headlines, what's the plan in your head for deploying some of the cash you have at that time, if you're going to? New Harbor guys, let's start with you. Maybe John.
Yeah, that's it. You prefaced that the same way I would, Adam. It's very difficult to say in a vacuum. We'd obviously want to look at where we are and where things are. But I think we've long talked about real assets and precious metal mining companies, especially. They've had quite a healthy pullback here. We think things like that should likely do very well if the Fed does pivot in a panicked way to more of an easing environment. In theory, things like tech stocks should get a bid, even though they've been beaten up recently more substantially than other value type stocks. But the bottom line is we would look for the kinds of things that traditionally have done well in a lower rate environment or things like precious metals, even bonds can be a good trade in that scenario. Be careful there though, because depending on how and when they get rolled out, could be in the middle of a bond crisis, who knows, but we think the yields on treasuries would likely go quite a bit lower from where they are now, which is priced in a lot of Fed tightening. Those are my quick thoughts. Mike, I don't know if you have anything to add. I'm sure Lance has something to add there too.
I really don't have much there. I guess I would only say that we lean heavily on technical analysis during that time, and we'll look to see which sectors have the relative strength advantage. And we will, be very active in looking at that.
Yeah, I agree with Mike and John. At that point, when you're in the middle of the crisis, so you think back to late 2008, and as we're wrapping up 2008, markets are plunging, we do TARP, and we all kind of thought we were near a bottom at that point, and then we found out there was another 22% to go in January and February. So markets can be really dicey, even if the Fed's becoming more active, we got the government coming in to do stuff, markets can still decline. So cash is going to be king going into this. And again, this is, just like, Mike and John, we're holding a lot of cash as well right now. But once we start getting into that, what seems to be that capitulatory, everything's breaking, baby with the bathwater going out type thing, margin debt getting reduced to, which has been coming down, but I think we'll start to see those margin calls really kick in. And once you see all that liquidation kind of occur, then it'll be just a function of going in and saying, look, there's going to be some great companies that are on sale. Here's an interesting concept for you, right? Inside of ARK Fund, which has been getting completely blasted, there's a bunch of companies in the ARK Fund that will no longer exist when the bear market's over. But there's some companies in there that are going to be the next, Amazon, Apple, those type of things. If you go back to the dot-com crisis, Apple, Amazon, these companies lost 90% of their value and then turned around and went to become the companies they are today. And that's going to be the same structure with some of these companies. There are companies in there with real cash flows, real income streams. They're still overpriced right now, but you get those valuations down, they're going to become a lot more compelling. There's going to be a lot of other great quality companies that are just going to be on really deep sell. I mean, just as an example, we were just looking at Walmart and Target today. Just looking at their valuation structures, after this big recent decline both those stocks had, these stocks are trading at price to sales of 0.5, right? 0.7. They've got, Walmart's got a 0.5 debt to equity ratio. I mean, these are very, very healthy companies that generate long-term cash flow and equity returns. So it'll just be a function of, you know, sifting through the rubble to find where, you know, value is. And look, that at the end of the day, that's what investing is all about. It's about finding companies that have value, have cash flow, and you can make long-term bets at that point. Look, there's going to be a lot of corporate debt that is on the verge of crisis, right? And you know, we were back in 2008, we were buying a lot of corporate bonds that were distressed. But you look at the balance sheet, these companies are just cash generation machines. The bonds were under a lot of pressure because the whole bond market was under pressure. But, you know, you can make really great returns in beating up fixed income as well and have that guarantee of repayment function, you know, at maturity of those bonds. So there's going to be so much opportunity. It's going to be hard to pick out exactly where you want to deploy money, but that's where the homework comes in.
That's a great answer. And it sounds like it did, but when you bought those distressed bonds in what I'm assuming were pretty blue chip companies that had been battered up, that worked out pretty well for you.
Oh yeah. Well, a good example, I can give you a good example. We do this all the time, but remember when British Petroleum, they had that well blow up in the Gulf of Mexico, the Condo well.
Yeah.
So they were pricing BP bonds for bankruptcy and they were trading at 70, 80 cents on the dollar at that point. And you looked at their cash flow balance sheet, the balance sheet and cash flow statement of British Petroleum, they were generating in a quarter what they expected payment was going to be, the penalties and the fines for that well. And you're going, well, if they just give up one quarter's of revenue, they've solved this problem and go forward. So we bought those bonds like crazy and about, you know, 4 months later, they were trading back at par. So there's, you know, when you get those kind of distressed asset sales, when everybody's just kind of baby with the bathwater thing, there's some great, great opportunities in fixed income. Howard Marks made his whole career doing exactly that.
All right. You know, it's interesting. So you, just like, and this has gone on forever, we think it's normal, but just sort of in a mania, like we sort of had for the past 10 years, people are willing to overpay for a company's value because they're really euphoric about what the future may bring. You guys are saying the same thing happens on the way down and people are overly pessimistic. And so you can pick these diamonds, you know, in the rough off the street because people are just, they've given up, right? We've already talked about, you know, we're not in a bear market. We know that because in a true bear market, nobody wants to touch a stock or a bond. I want to just give a shout out to this guy, Charge Mopar. I'm going to put up his comment here. I've been out of the market since 2007 and I'm so eager to pick up distressed assets for the future. So this guy is like the epitome of the investor that we're talking to here right now. This poor guy has been waiting for his blood in the streets moment for a decade and a half at this point. I hope he gets it.
Hey, you know, Adam, I can't tell you, I've got more than a handful of clients that are just like that, that have been out of the market since 2008, 2009. And that's truly the mark of a bear market. When you get a bear market, a true bear market, nobody wants to buy assets at all. And the problem is that once the bear market turns, well, it's just, that's a rally and it's going to fail and it's going to go lower and then it keeps going up and then they just never get back in the market. That's human psychology and why bear markets are so devastating. But after 2001 and two, people left the market, never came back. 2008, people left the market, never came back. 1973, 74, exactly. The reason they call 1973, 74 a black bear market, it was so bad that when people left, they were out for good.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the cat that jumps on the hot stove isn't going to jump on a hot stove again, but he's not going to jump on a cold stove either, right? And that's why these asset bubbles, they used to be once in a generation, because people would remember that pain and they would change their behavior permanently, you know, not too dissimilar how the folks that grew up in the Great Depression, you know, they, no matter how prosperous they got later in life, they were still storing flour up in the attic and stuff like that, right? But what's unique about the current period we're in is we're now in the third bubble, basically in the past 20 years, right? You know, dot-com bubble, great financial crisis bubble, and then a real estate bubble, and then now the everything bubble here. So for some reason, we're just not learning our lesson this time around.
That would be the Fed not learning our lesson.
The Fed. But we're, you know, a lot of people are still participating and following, you know, the little red laser dot that the Fed is, you know, moving around for us to chase. Exactly. All right. So we're already over the hour. If you guys don't mind, let's go another 5 or 6 minutes or so here. I want to get into, you guys are all financial advisors. And at the end of the day, yes, your job is to think about where markets are headed and whatnot, but then you've got to translate that into real action for real people. So I want to kind of hear from you, each of you, how you're doing that. And I want to combine it with another question folks have been asking about here. There have been lots of questions about odds of a coming recession. There's been questions about, you know, is the housing market going to break? I've talked individually about each of those with you guys in recent videos. But basically, there's sort of two major components to wealth building, right? There's the income generating, right? You've got to generate your income to have excess income to then invest. And then there's the investing of what do you do with that and how do you deploy it? We may be entering a really challenging period for people where their earning potential may be getting compromised because of layoffs or cut hours or just slowing economy, right? And the markets may continue their volatility. And we may see, as we talked about, you know, there's potential for substantially lower prices ahead. So how are you guys helping the people that you're talking with every day who are, you know, watching these videos, reaching out, having those consultations with you? You know, I don't know if I have a super specific question about this, except just to say, you know, it's a tough landscape we're looking at here. How are you helping people with this? Mike, why don't we start with you?
Okay, I'll try to be brief. If they're new people, if they're not our clients and they feel somewhat stuck, like a lot of people feel right now, we'll help them get unstuck. That's it.
Great. And, hey, Mike, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you, but I've got this little ticker for people that don't watch this channel very much and don't know about the free consultations they can have with all you guys. You just go to wealthion.com. I just put a little ticker at the bottom of the screen here. So if you decide after this video, you want to talk to any of the guys talking about here, that's where you should go. All right. Sorry to interrupt, Mike.
But no problem. So we'll just help them get unstuck. And no one knows how far down this market could go. If data has any connection to reality, this market could go a lot lower over time. So we want to help them get unstuck first and foremost. And a lot of that's psychological, and we'll help them. Most of, you know, if I could just condense it into one sentence, I'd say just do something. You know, your timing will not be right. Just do something. Sell a little bit down if you're too exposed to equities, and then maybe a little more later. And, you know, we'd be happy to help you. And as I'm sure Lance would be too, to have, you know, to help you think through that and at least, you know, figure out a way to get started. You ask about how to navigate. Nobody knows for sure. We live in an era of just really wild, deranged central banking, and nobody knows when it will break. It will probably break the system to some extent at some point. Nobody knows when. For that reason, we want people to have real assets. Gold and silver are just a core position, an actual gold and silver. Maybe 10% of investable assets is a good place to start. For the financial assets that are left after that is done, those are the assets that we manage. Or if you're doing it yourself, you can mirror what we're talking about. We still hold a pretty high percentage of cash. We're close to 30% cash, down from maybe 50 a couple months ago. We have added some tactical longs that are hedged with or paired with some hedges just for a quick bounce. We don't expect anything other than the ability to just enter this market for a bounce. If you're doing this on your own, I wouldn't even bother to do that. I would just do what I said earlier, to review your allocations and get down to where you're going to feel comfortable, no matter what comes. And if you're overexposed, again, just do something. And other than that, the sectors that we like throughout this process are things that are related to real things. Like I mentioned, gold and silver. We also, though, like energy stocks, oil and silver, oil and gas. Service companies we have in our portfolio right now, also basic materials, but commodities in general should do really well. Agriculture. Somebody, I think, put a question up earlier about wheat, which is at $12 a bushel. I mean, it's probably going to go higher based on charts, maybe 14 or 15. But we think that we've entered a commodity cycle that's going to be favorable over the next decade. So that should really have a pretty consistent weighting in your thinking and in your portfolio over time.
All right, great. John, I'll let you chime in and maybe just sort of seed your answer here, which is, you know, in this highly uncertain environment where people are understandably stressed about the sort of the twin risks that I just mentioned and where emotions are running hot, I imagine, you know, first and foremost, just coming up with a plan is a really valuable step here, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Just talking about it, frankly, is hugely therapeutic. And I'm going to use that word because no doubt about it, Lance, Mike, and I and our colleagues we are therapists when things get crazy and psychological, like bubble markets can do. And I, you know, have no hesitation calling the current environment a very psychologically charged environment. But also, you know, look, if we're in a big paradigm shift, you know, these cycles can go on for many years, decades. If you look at the inflationary environment in the 70s, for example, you know, I hate to be draconian and whatnot, but behavior changes may be important. You know, watching spending. I mean, we have to help our clients look at both sides of the balance sheet, the or the income statement, the assets, but also their spending. And one of the very things that one can do to have the most control over is their expenses. Obviously, there are living expenses that are necessary and baseline that you can't control. But being careful, you know, realizing that one of your best assets is yourself and your ability to learn new skills and earn an income possibly or whatever. Just reorienting that not everything centers around your portfolio is what I'm trying to get to.
All right, great. And Lance, I'm going to let you bat cleanup here, and I can hear your phone. I know you're probably getting pulled into your next meeting, so we'll keep it going.
It's 45, so no worries. So look, I'm going to take this from a little different perspective because I get a lot of phone calls, you know, people just really stressed out about, you know, the market and, you know, and it doesn't matter whether they've got 10% exposure or 100% exposure to stocks, just the fact that the market's down, they're not sleeping at night, you know, they're just completely stressed out. Look, you know, there's nothing that says that you've got to be invested in the stock market. And I just wrote an article on our website. So if you go to realinvestmentadvice.com, there's an article right on the front page called How to Invest in a Recession. And we kind of go through what is a recession, what does it mean, you know, what to, how to prepare for it and those type of things. But the bottom line is look, I mean, it's great to be invested. That's how we're going to make money long term. And that's absolutely a true story. But, you know, if it's ruining your health, right, it's ruining your relationship, it's ruining your time with your family and these important things of just called life, get out of the market for right now. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with being in cash until, you know, there's something else that is clearer about your life and direction, particularly if you're worried about potentially losing your job, et cetera. You know, there's, you know, that's, you know, that is a step. You can do that. You know, the problem with getting all into cash, as we said before, and like with the gentleman listening to the show, is like once you're out, the problem is getting back in. And that's where you really need somebody to kind of help you get back into the markets and do those things. And look, John and Mike and myself, we're that's what we do for a living. You know, yeah, we're all sitting on a lot of cash right now. We're sitting on bonds, we're hedged, we're doing all those type of things. And we're trading this market from a real-time standpoint, but that's what we do all day, every day. This is our job, right? But if you're trying to do this on your own and it's ruining your life, stop. You know, you don't have to keep doing it. And then you can always kind of reevaluate, reassess, and start over. And there's nothing wrong with that. The media will never tell you that because the media wants you to give them their money so they can manage it for you and charge you a fee. But sometimes you just got to step back and start over. And there's, and again, like I said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And you can at least kind of reassess what your goals really are, what's really important to you. Because we all get swept up into the greed, the emotion, you know, the 2021, you know, I saw so many people on my Facebook page talking about this market's so easy. Why do I need an advisor? I just throw money in. Well, now you know why, because it doesn't always just go up. But this is where the rubber meets the road. And this is where we find out who really can invest and who can't. And if you're in the you can't camp, it's time to reassess where your goals are, because again, this will have lasting impacts down the road. It will affect your financial outcome. And if you lose 50% of your money between now and the end of this bear market, you will never actually get back to where your goals were, because you lose all the time getting back to even. And that is not the same thing as making money.
All right. Well, look, a ton of questions that we did not get to, but I'm going to end it here on that excellent just parting context that all three of you just gave here. You know, at the end of the day, the reason why we do all of this is to help people build wealth. And you guys just gave sort of a great, you know, hey, if that's your objective, you got to keep the big picture in mind in the way that you guys just described. So thank you. So as we wrap things up here, folks, Let us know if you continue to want to see us do these live Q&As. If you like this format and want to see us do it on a regular basis in the future, let us know in the comments section here. Ideally, I'd like to try to get to do this monthly if my financial advisor partners here are willing to do it. If that sounds good to you, let us know. Obviously, if you're enjoying it, please help support this channel so that we can continue bringing it to you by hitting the like button and then clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And obviously, folks, what we're trying to do with these sessions is to try to get as many people as possible, both educated, but then mobilized to taking prudent steps to protect and hopefully prudently grow their wealth. As we say often, you know, and we've reiterated a lot in this conversation, we think you should do so working under the partnership of a professional financial advisor that gets all of the risks and the macro trends that we're talking about here. If you've got a great one, excellent, stick with them. But if you don't, or you want a second opinion, you'd like to hear from some of the guys that just talked about here, just click on or just go to the wealthion.com URL you're seeing scrolling across the bottom of the screen here. They give free consultations. There's no commitment to work with these guys. They just literally do it as a public service because they want to help people. All right, folks. Well, hopefully we'll see you on one of these a month from now. But do me a quick favor. And again, just in the comment section, please thank these professional financial advisors for joining us. I corralled them out of their very busy work weeks to come do this. They gave us more time than I told them I would take from them. So if you want to see them come again, please just give them a nice warm round of thanks here. And with that, folks, Mike, John, Lance, thanks so much for joining, guys. This is a great discussion. As always, it's always super educational, but also super fun. And everybody else, thanks so much for watching. We'll see you the next time we do one of these.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks, Lance. See you all.
See you guys.
Appreciate everybody listening.